Hi, it's William Brangham. You may have seen or heard our recent reports on the NewsHour about our trip to Antarctica. Now, we're bringing you our first ever original podcast series. It's called The Last Continent. And we'll give you a much closer look at the curious creatures who live there and the equally curious people who study them.
Look at them go underwater. Zoom, zoom, zoom. You look.
I know, it's incredible.
Literally flying underwater.
We'll take you on a first-hand journey showing how climate change is transforming this distant continent.
Theoretically, ocean water could get in under the edge of the glacier and undermine it from below as well.
More than theoretically, in fact, we know that's occurring in parts of West Antarctica and East Antarctica. This system is overall out of balance.
And how it could impact our lives thousands of miles away.
That much sea level rise would be very, very difficult and expensive to defend against.
I think it's absolutely incredible that our seventh continent, our newest continent, was discovered less than 200 years ago, changing what we understand about the globe today.
All four episodes of The Last Continent drop April 24th. Subscribe today wherever you get your podcasts.
On this edition for Sunday, April 21st, deadly blasts rock Sri Lankan churches and hotels on Easter Sunday. The creator of the comic strip Kathy on the grown-up years. And an uncommon library preserving living history. Next on PBS NewsHour Weekend.
From the Tisch WNET studios at Lincoln Center in New York, Hari Srinivasan.
Good evening and thanks for joining us. As worshippers gathered for Easter services in Christian churches in Sri Lanka this morning, a wave of bombings killed more than 200 people, including several Americans. Police there say it was a coordinated terrorist attack carried out by suicide bombers at churches and hotels in three cities. At least 207 people were killed and 450 wounded in eight separate bomb blasts. In Sri Lanka's largest city of Colombo, bombs went off at a Catholic church and three luxury hotels. A few hours later, at a Catholic church in the city of Negombo, a bomb killed at least 67 people. And in the eastern city of Batticaloa, 27 people died in a bombing at a Protestant church. It was the deadliest terror attack since the end of the country's civil war 10 years ago.
I see this as a serious situation aimed at destabilizing the country and the economy. I strongly condemn this attack aimed at religious institutions and some hotels in the capital.
Three police officers were also killed during a raid on a suspected safe house just outside the capital when another bomb detonated. At least seven suspects have been arrested, but no group has claimed responsibility. Authorities have imposed a nationwide curfew until dawn tomorrow and a temporary social media ban to prevent the spread of misinformation. Pope Francis condemned the violence in Sri Lanka in his traditional Easter Sunday address this morning.
I learned with sadness and sorrow the news of the grave attacks that today, on Easter Day, have brought grief and sorrow to churches and other community places in Sri Lanka.
Speaking to a crowd of about 70,000 people in St. Peter's Square, the Pope also urged politicians to welcome refugees and for an end to conflicts in Syria, Libya, and Venezuela. For the latest on the explosions in Sri Lanka, visit pbs.org/newshour. Next Friday marks an anniversary that's sometimes overlooked. It'll be 33 years since the Chernobyl nuclear power plant, then in the former Soviet Union, now in Ukraine, blew apart after an unexpected power surge. The Soviet government initially remained silent, but within days of April 26, 1986, hundreds of thousands of people were evacuated. Dozens died in the months following, and radiation contaminated a huge area that remains uninhabited today. Earlier this weekend, I spoke with Adam Higginbotham, author of Midnight in Chernobyl, the untold story of the world's greatest nuclear disaster. This is almost 33 years ago, and here you are putting out a book now. What's untold about it?
Well, I would say that the principal aspect of what's untold about it is that this version of the story is true.
What did we get wrong?
Well, because the Soviet government did such an excellent job of attempting to cover up the truth at the beginning. Mm. You know, most people's conceptions of what happened are kind of rooted in the initial propaganda that the Soviet Union put out, and also the misinformation that resulted from a lack of information. So, for example, you know, a lot of people still think that tens of thousands of people died almost immediately as a result of this accident.
That's not the case.
That's not the case. But part of the reason for that is Western correspondents in Moscow weren't allowed access to any information. So they did their best with kind of rumors and hearsay, with the result that I think within a week of the accident, the New York Post was reporting that 15,000 people had died and their bodies buried in a nuclear waste dump somewhere in Ukraine.
And when in fact it was what?
When in fact the death toll from the accident by that point was two.
Two.
One man died in the initial explosion. A second man died by dawn that day as a result of burns he sustained in the explosion.
And then how do we calculate the ones who sort of got horrible cancers?
I mean, the official figures are that within 5 months, another 29 people had died as a result of radiation exposure they received in those few hours after the first explosion. But then when you start to try and attribute cancers directly to the results of the accident, things get a lot trickier because of the complexities of epidemiology, but also because of the extent of the attempts at a cover-up by the Soviet government.
You know, in a way, when you look at this in a larger picture, this is almost one of the things, I think, that collapsed the Soviet Union. This catastrophe and what they had to pay to try to clean this up. I mean, I don't know what the rest of the Soviet economy was doing at the time, but it was really startling.
Yeah, so, I mean, the cost of the accident certainly didn't help an already sort of staggering Soviet economy.
Right.
But I think that the more significant impact that it had in contributing to the collapse of the empire was the way it changed Gorbachev's mind. He was pursuing these ideas of glasnost and perestroika, of economic reform in particular, quite softly in the lead-up to the accident. It was only after Chernobyl that he really realized exactly how deep the rot went in the system that he'd inherited. And that seems to have encouraged him to kind of plunge into these economic reforms at quite reckless speed.
Yeah.
And as a result, those reforms were botched. That really destroyed the Soviet Union.
Yeah. This isn't a book that's necessarily against nuclear technology or for. It seems to be more about how we collectively put so much faith in technology.
I think that's right. I mean, I've tried to show the facts of what happened rather than, you know, including any polemic that's either pro or anti-nuclear energy. I think the wider lesson of the story is one of overconfidence in technology, which I think is really, you know, is obviously still with us today.
Yeah, besides Facebook, we're talking about big data that we're not as conscious of, artificial intelligence.
Exactly.
That is,
and we're assuming it's always improving our lives
rather
than perhaps, you know, controlling and altering the way things happen.
All right, Adam Higginbotham, Midnight in Chernobyl is the name of the book. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
The popular comic strip Kathy chronicled one single woman's struggles with love, food, and her mother for more than three decades. It was based loosely on the life of its creator, Kathy Geiswhite, who's out with a new book, a collection of funny essays about the struggles of the next chapter of life. NewsHour Weekend's Megan Thompson has more.
In 1976, Kathy Geiswhite was 26 years old and already a vice president at a Detroit ad agency. But she secretly felt miserable about not achieving some more traditional goals, like finding a boyfriend.
My generation was right in between the two Bettys, Betty Crocker and Betty Friedan. And I wanted to be both of them. And a lot of women did at that time. And I literally gained 40 pounds on one Betty's chocolate fudge layer cake mix while reading the other Betty's Feminine Mystique. And a lot of women, I think, found themselves like the place I was in.
How did Kathy start?
After college, I was working in an advertising agency. I was very successful, and I was feeling the full frustration of the success of my job and the failure of my relationships. So I wrote about it in my journals. And one night, I felt so pathetic writing and eating everything in the kitchen, waiting for the Mr. Wrong to call, that I drew a picture of what I looked like. I sent that drawing home to Mom. And Mom, who had told me to never share anything publicly, said, oh, this could be a comic strip for millions of people to enjoy. So Mom went to the library, researched comic strip syndicates, sent me a list of who to approach, and just to get Mom off my back, I sent some scribbles, not in comic strip form, to the name at the top of her list.
The scribbles worked. Universal Press Syndicate, a national syndicator of comics and newspaper columns, offered Geiswhite a contract.
Had you had any training in drawing or cartooning?
I had zero training in art. When I received a contract back to do a comic strip for the rest of my life, it came with a note saying they were sure I would learn how to draw if I had to do it 365 days a year.
And you did.
And I did.
Kathy was brutally honest about the life of a real woman, and it was a hit. It debuted in 1976 and, at peak distribution, appeared in 1,400 newspapers around the country.
Kathy is a hopeful character who dealt with, I used to say she dealt with the four basic guilt groups, food, love, mom, and career, and trying to juggle them all and find her way, navigate life through those things.
The comic chronicled the cartoon character's quests to find a flattering swimsuit and find a husband, all while negotiating her beloved and badgering fictional mother.
Kathy was wildly popular. I mean, why do you think it resonated so much with so many people?
Life is a balance between, you know, our dreams and our fantasies and our hopes for ourselves and the reality of what happens in the day. I think that for a lot of us, a lot of things stack up on us and in us that we don't even know. Things that work on us, that chip away at our time, our sense of ourself, our sense of competence, so that even the days that start triumphant kind of end, you know, with a box of frozen Girl Scout cookies. I think that a lot of women went through the same things and are still going through the same things today, and that the comic strip character is a friend to them. That's the most common thing I ever heard from people, is, I feel like you know me, you know, I feel like Kathy is my friend. I feel like we're soul sisters, and I loved getting to be that for people.
But it wasn't all popularity. Kathy had more than its share of critics.
Some people said, this is a character who's just obsessed with her weight and dating and relationships, and maybe not the most feminist in that respect.
I was surprised by the criticism a bit, because I felt like when I was writing about shopping, and I wrote about shopping a lot, I wrote about it because it was a microcosm of the extra expectations and the extra stuff that comes on women. Just the simple act of buying a white shirt for a woman is like a 15-department, you know, styles, cuts, fabric, manufacturers. You have to try everything on. A man just goes in and buys a white shirt off the rack. So it wasn't me writing about shopping. It was writing about what shopping did to women.
Geiswhite's Kathy comic strip ran for 34 years before she retired, in part to spend more time with her aging parents. But now, Geiswhite is back with a new book of humorous essays, 50 Things That Aren't My Fault. It chronicles what happened after Geiswhite's retirement.
You write about sort of again being caught in the middle now in this stage of life.
Well, people call this the sandwich generation, and it feels so much more squashed than that. I call it the panini generation, because on one hand, I'm caring for aging parents who don't listen to me, and on the other hand, an aging daughter who doesn't listen to me, and I'm squashed in the middle in an aging body that definitely does not listen to me, and aware, like so many of my generation are, that we're running out of time to do all the things that we thought we still want to do.
In the book, Geiswhite tries to convince her 90-year-old parents to wear emergency alert pendants. And then there's trying to understand the world of her daughter, now in her 20s.
Back in the 70s, our big dream was to be able to have a career and have a family at once. That was having it all. For my daughter's generation, having it all is having a career, having a family, having a social media presence, having a YouTube channel, having a blog, having a being a community activist, being a global a force for global change. She has like 10,000 more things to feel like that she can do, but to feel like she should be doing to keep up with everybody. And I think at the end, way less freedom to say that she's overstressed or can't handle it or feels bad about herself. My dream for 50 Things That Aren't My Fault is that it will be a friend to women, the same way that the comic strip was a friend to women, that it will help women feel like they're not alone, that it will help women laugh at the little things so we can all kind of have the strength and energy to get on to the big things, and that it will also help women look backward with a little bit of grace and forgiveness and look forward, face the future knowing there are a lot of things that aren't our fault.
When is an old home movie of interest to anyone beyond the immediate family? The answer can be found in a digital archive run by a San Francisco-based couple who are compiling and curating the work of thousands of amateur filmmakers and turning it into living history. And that's not all they're doing. NewsHour Weekend special correspondent Joanne Elgar-Jennings has our report.
For anybody, this would be an incredible find. A 70-year-old reel of home movie footage that had been hidden in an attic.
Oh, it's all going so fast, but these are the family. That's my mother.
Really?
If I'm not mistaken, that's the only home movie footage I've ever seen of my mom, which is astonishing. My mother died in 2002. This is a part of her life we don't know much about, but she was in Europe after the war.
For Rick Prelinger, it's particularly poignant. He spent a career peering into other people's pasts, using home movies as his lens on history.
You can't distill history down to a few ideas. It isn't true that things were simpler and safer and people were friendlier in the old days. It's infinitely more complex.
Prelinger and his wife Megan have amassed 17,000 home movies, some 1,200 hours of footage. It's all contained in a digital library called the Prelinger Archives, which makes most of its footage available for free to the public.
He's kind of a cult character, actually, among filmmakers, because you can now have stock footage for free. I think it's also not just for documentarians. It's the next generation, a very visual generation. So they want to see what the 20th century looked like and felt like.
Brewster Kahle founded San Francisco's nonprofit Internet Archive, which digitizes the Prelinger material for free. It includes not just home movies, but also some 5,000 industrial and educational films. Kahle says those help give a truer picture of the past than anything created by big movie studios.
Hollywood is sort of a little edited. And so these old industrial films, training films, home movies, they're more raw. They're kind of more of what real life was like. And you can relate to it.
From major finds to tiny details, Prelinger knows the contents of his vast digital archive intimately.
Back and forth. Again, this is 1928. It's a very charismatic and very beautiful family.
But he's done more than just collect and catalog the footage. Prelinger has used it to craft a unique film series called Lost Landscapes. The carefully edited montages present the life of a city across 100 years, in the span of about an hour. So far, he's created films about New York, Detroit, Oakland, Los Angeles, and San Francisco. In its 13th year, the series has gained quite a following. A screening in January packed the Internet Archives Auditorium in San Francisco. This film has no narration, barely any audio, in fact.
You are the soundtrack. This is crucially important. I'm going to give you some background, and I'm going to do some identifications. And if you're quiet, I'm going to try to antagonize you so you speak up.
Prelinger guides the audience to yell out memories and reactions as the images roll by.
There's a newsboy!
There's something amazing about giving people the opportunity to violate the rules and talk during the movie. I think it's really a case of people owning history in a way that they wouldn't if they were told what to think and what to feel.
Prelinger also provides some live narration of his own.
This is the bathtub. It's Skipper. He's taking Native activists to Alcatraz for the occupation.
This scene shows Native American activists heading to a protest on Alcatraz Island in San Francisco Bay.
This was shot by a man named Oswald Sykes in 1970.
Oswald Sykes is the kind of filmmaker the Prelinger Archives specialize in, an amateur with a keen eye.
His daughter, Kim, is in the audience tonight.
Kim Sykes has been attending Lost Landscapes for years, but for a long time she felt something was missing.
I hadn't seen people of color in a lot of the footage in the years that I'd gone to the show.
So she convinced her father to make his footage available.
These are African Americans coming out of the Fairmont Hotel. I thought it was important to show that, you know, San Francisco is very diverse.
Prelinger says home movies show much more diversity than the commercial film record.
Beginning in the 30s, when 8mm was developed, it was sufficiently inexpensive that almost everybody could shoot home movies. You see farmers shooting home movies, young people shooting films, Latinx people shooting films. It's this great sort of flowering of democratic expression.
In addition to documenting the 20th century's human experience, Prelinger's films show how dramatically our urban landscapes have changed.
So this is the Sunset District before it was built up. You see, it's all dunes. The western side of San Francisco is built on the dunes. You know, when the places we live change rapidly, we notice the increments, we notice the short-term changes, but we don't always get a chance to sit back and think about how they've accumulated, how much a place has changed maybe in 20, 30, 40, 50 years.
In the 2017 film Lost Landscapes of New York, viewers travel from the Depression era with Hoovervilles and a garment worker strike to desperate housing conditions in Harlem in the 1940s.
So the L is being torn down.
There's also a ride on the Third Avenue elevated train, the last piece of a railway that once ran the length of Manhattan before it was torn down in the 1950s. In addition to the digital film archive, Prelinger and his wife Megan have created a physical archive called the Prelinger Library. It's devoted to what they term ephemera.
Our culture leaves a great deal of ephemeral material behind, but it turns out to be incredibly illuminating evidence of how we lived, how we worked, how we played, what was important to us.
One example, a collection of U.S. Department of Agriculture documents that spans the 19th and 20th centuries. Megan Prelinger explains how that relic of the past might help illuminate the present.
And information, for instance, about insect populations of the 1880s might not have been interesting in 1950, but today, with a crisis in the health of worldwide insect populations, it becomes urgent.
The Prelinger Library has become a communal space for artists and researchers from all around the country.
This is great.
Good. Well, we aim to please.
Jeremy Farris is working on an illustrated book about the history of pollution along the Hudson River in upstate New York.
Oh, yeah, this is the one that I was looking for.
A lot of these maps and, like, kind of obsolete reports are really great to have in hand.
And once a month, the library hosts artist-led talks.
So the dahlia is the official flower of San Francisco.
Rick Prelinger says that building community, both here in the library and through the digital film archive, is part of what he calls an historic intervention.
A place like this helps you not take the present for granted. A place like this helps you step back from what we assume to be true and think about alternatives. A place like this helps you think about the continuing presence of history and how we have the opportunity to change history on our own.
This is PBS NewsHour Weekend, Sunday.
In Italy, archaeologists are uncovering more treasures from the city of Pompeii, where thousands were killed when Mount Vesuvius suddenly erupted in the year AD 79. Pompeii's ruins cover close to 165 acres, and one-third of the site is still buried under volcanic ash and stone, making it both a popular tourist attraction and an active excavation site. The latest finds include two complete houses with brilliantly colored wall paintings of Greek gods and mythological figures.
It is very beautiful and in very good condition, so the colors are very bright, and also the rest of the room is a very beautiful decoration.
The colors faded after ash was removed and moisture on the surface of the wall dried out, but restoration is underway.
We will clean this and we will protect it, and so we will get the beautiful colors back.
The new discoveries are part of the final stages of what Italy calls the Great Pompeii Project. It was launched in 2012 after a series of collapses and flooding over the centuries destroyed some of Pompeii's fragile walls and buildings. Teams of construction workers are now shoring up mounds of earth that threaten to crush ruins where the newly discovered art is being restored on fragile walls.
In the past, they preferred to excavate vast areas, but especially in the 18th century, this caused the destruction of many houses that were not preserved, were not they had not restorations.
Conservationists say the newly uncovered homes with their paintings may be fully uncovered and open to the public within the next 2 years. Finally tonight, Ukraine's President Petro Poroshenko conceded to challenger Volodymyr Zelensky in a runoff election today. According to exit polls, Zelensky, a 41-year-old comic actor with no previous political experience, defeated Poroshenko by a margin of more than 3-1. PBS NewsHour special correspondent Simon Ostrovsky recently visited Zelensky on his set and spoke with him about his chances of winning. To see the full segment, go to pbs.org/newshour. That's all for this edition of PBS NewsHour Weekend. I'm Hari Srinivasan. Thanks for watching. Have a good night.